Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicles Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Moira O'Neill and joining me today are my colleagues Chris Dillow, the Investors Chronicles economist, Deputy Personal Finance Editor Leonora Walters and Personal Finance Writer Kate Bearley. We're also delighted to have special guest Adrian Lowcock of AXA Wealth on the show. We're going to be talking about the budget and the implications for savers and investors. On the one hand, we've seen some improvements to ISAs, but on the other hand, we've seen a reduction of the pension's lifetime allowance to £1 million. So overall, do we think the budget changes are good for savers and investors? Adrian Lowcock, could I start with you, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what we've seen with ISAs is a little bit of tinkering around the edges, really. So improved flexibility for cash ISAs, being able to take money out and then put it back in the same tax year, and an introduction of the Help to Buy ISA. And that in itself is quite complicated. The Help to Buy, there's lots of sort of rules and governing what, when you can use it, how you can use it, and I think we'll probably need to see more detail on that over time to see how it's executed, because there's sort of limitations on how much you can put in, restrictions on when you can use it, what's price of house purchase you can use it. And the other interesting thing that affects ISAs is the personal savings allowance, whereby basically taxpayers can get £1,000 tax-free on their savings, which really puts a question mark over the role that cash ISAs will play for a lot of savers, because cash ISAs effectively do the same job. They give you tax-free savings, but this £1,000 allowance will effectively take a lot of people out of the need for cash ISAs, so they may find that they could use their cash ISAs in stocks and shares and use the whole allowance of stocks and shares instead of cash. So it's quite interesting sort of rule changes on ISAs, and I think it's time perhaps to take a pause and review the whole ISA to make sure we don't lose what's critical and what makes it successful, which has been its simplicity and straightforwardness about it. And I'm keen that we sort of pause and just, you know, let the dust settle for a while.
Okay, so the fact that the Chancellor has abolished the savings taxes on the first £1,000 does mean you might need to re-examine that those cash ISA holdings.
I would probably sort of hesitate that and emphasise that if you've already got a cash ISA, then you shouldn't rush to do anything, because the ISA wrapper is still very popular with the government. It's a very well-recognised tax-efficient wrapper, and you know, governments may change and policies may change, and the ISA wrapper could change, and therefore you'd probably be better keeping it in the ISA wrapper than giving up a wrapper.
Okay. Now, Chris Dillow, do you have a feeling whether the budget changes are overall good for savers and investors?
I think, insofar as they do anything, they are mildly good. I mean, that personal savings allowance is worth £200 for anyone with sufficient savings to benefit fully from it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's put that into context. If you've got £100,000 split between cash and equities evenly, then £200 is just a 0.4% rise in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the difference between a mildly average day and a moderately decent day. So in that sense, these changes are very, very small. And one could argue that the best thing to happen for savers yesterday was the change in the Federal Reserve's projected path for interest rates, which led to quite a steep rise in the market.
Yes.
You know, that's probably enriched us more than the Chancellor's measure.
So nothing to do with the budget at all there. It's market forces elsewhere that are more important overall than the budget.
Quite possibly, yes. I mean, the main event of the day was in the US, not the UK.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that cropped up in the budget, which was actually flagged in advance, was that the Chancellor is going to consult on how to set up a market that will enable retired investors who've already bought their annuities to sell them on. Do you think that's a good idea, Chris, to sell an annuity?
If you're on your deathbed, it might well be. But otherwise, I find it very difficult to believe that you'll get decent value for it, for the simple reason that if you want to sell an annuity, your annuity provider will regard that as a sign that you haven't got very long to live and will therefore offer you a pretty pitiful price for it. It's the old-fashioned adverse selection problem.
I mean, these are secure income for life that we're talking about here. I know a lot of even wealthy investors will buy an annuity to secure a minimum level of income in retirement, and that may continue despite all the new pension freedoms. What do you think, Adrian Locock? Would you agree with me on that?
I think the issue with this is that, yes, you do need to consider why you bought the annuity in the first place, and it gives you that secure income, and annuities will continue to play an important role in retirement planning, because having a fixed income, a guaranteed income, even for the very well-off, is really useful for all those everyday spends, the necessaries that you need to spend retirement money on. I think the secondary annuity market is probably going to remain somewhat small and probably ineffective because, as Chris pointed out, you're not going to get a particularly attractive return on the sale, albeit the tax barriers will be removed. The value you'll actually get for an annuity will probably remain quite low in the secondary market.
Looking beyond the budget, despite all the changes that come in, the issue that all investors are facing is how to save well for the long term. Chris Dillow, in this week's Reader Portfolio Clinic, you warn investors about something called creative destruction that can happen when you're investing for the long term. Chris, what is creative destruction and why does it matter for investors?
Well, creative destruction was a phrase coined by Joseph Schumpeter back in the 1930s. And what he meant by this was that economic growth doesn't come simply from existing firms getting bigger and selling more, but it comes instead from new firms arising and in effect taking the place of existing firms. And this matters enormously for investors because what it means is that if you hold a basket of firms that exist today, then in 20, 30 years' time, there's a fairly big risk that some of those firms will disappear or shrink to virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm. So you argue that this really is something which people need to think about when they're investing for the long term. You can't buy companies now and expect to hold everything for the next 30 years. You're going to have to do some trading to a certain extent. Is that right?
Well, maybe not, because the problem is that assumes that you'll be able to foresee the beneficiaries from creative destruction. And this isn't necessarily the case. I would favour tracker funds on this basis, for the simple reason that holding a capitalization weighted basket of shares gives you some sort of protection against creative destruction, because it means that as a particular company shrinks, then your holding of that company as a share of your portfolio shrinks with it, you know. Mm-hmm. And a tracker fund in effect automatically invests in new companies, and it invests according to their weight in the index.
Adrian Locock, when you're thinking about investing for the long term, do tracker funds spring to mind? Is that your
view? I think tracker funds have a role to play. In some markets, they really do suit, because active managers either struggle to outperform, or in the UK, we don't have access to the active managers that are good. So in the US in particular, it's a difficult market to get good active management. They're just not available to the UK retail investor. But on the other side, you can sort of identify good managers, and particularly in the UK smaller companies and mid-cap space, you can find good managers who are actually able to identify stocks and individual companies that are going to sort of come up the ranks and replace the establishment, if you like, and add value. So I think a blend is usually quite useful, because you can sort of complement a tracker portfolio with some really good active management fund managers, but it is about picking the few that are exceptional.
Chris, do you accept that you could introduce some active managers into the mix?
I'm not sure how that's possible over the very long run. I mean, you might be able to identify one or two exceptional managers over 1, 2, or 3 years, for example. But if you're talking about investing for 30 years, say on behalf of your children, or you just want a very easy way of preparing for your retirement, then there's very little chance that a good manager will remain good for that long. And there's also not much chance of you spotting him. So we've got some big uncertainties there. But there's one absolute certainty about active management, and that's that it costs you more than a tracker fund. And if you're investing for 30 years, then an extra management charge of 0.5% to 1% per year compounds absolutely horribly over 30 years. So it might be the case that you can do better than a tracker fund, but a tracker fund saves you the certain downside of higher fees. So for me, a tracker fund might not be fully optimal, but it's not a bad second best. You know, maybe there's a trade-off between optimising and satisfying. and satisfying suggests that we should have a very big weighting in trackers.
But if we want to add some active managers into the mix, Adrian, how do we improve our chances of selecting a good active manager? What do you need to look for?
It's getting that balance of looking for a manager who has a strong conviction in the process that they use and evidence that that process does work. And the understanding, I tend to look for managers who don't perhaps change their mind at a drop of a hat. So good managers will actually, as Chris rightly pointed out, they will go through periods of underperformance. The very best managers can sort of underperform for 3 to 5 years and come out the other end. So it's really about having a strong process, conviction in their processes, and an understanding of why, if that process isn't working, why it isn't working, and whether they need to do something to tweak it and fix that, or whether it's just a element of what's going on in the market. Because stock markets follow trends and fashions. They, you know, we had the dot-com era of the late 20th century, and that led to equity income funds being very unpopular for a long period of time, and then it's been replaced, and we've got equity income being very popular now. And managers who don't invest in those popular areas at the time will be out of fashion for a period, but that changes. So you've got to have, you know, understand what a manager does, and a manager to understand why they are performing and or not performing at the time. So it's really sort of making sure you've got a sort of mixture of things, but strong process, understanding of the process, and understanding of why the process is or isn't working. And I think that's some of the key characteristics I look for in a manager.
Great, thanks. Those are some great tips. Now, thanks very much, Adrian and Chris, for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In this week's magazine, Deputy Personal Finance Editor Leonora Walters has been looking in detail at enterprise investment schemes. These invest in private equity investments, typically early stage companies that are high risk but offer good growth prospects. And enterprise investment schemes also offer a number of generous tax reliefs, including 30% income tax relief if you hold the investments for 3 or more years. Now, Leonora, the Chancellor has actually announced some changes to enterprise investment schemes in the budget. Can you tell us about these?
Yes, it's not just enterprise investment schemes. It also affects venture capital trusts, VCTs, and seed enterprise investment schemes as well.
They're similar schemes that do private equity or early stage companies, and they have different types of
tax reliefs. Just first of all, I mean, probably not anything for investors to consider. It's for changes to the investment rules that the managers running them will have to consider. So generally, managers aren't too concerned. I think that's the main thing. So I don't think that you know, the investment prospects of these funds are particularly under threat. One of the main changes is that VCT and EIS will no longer be able to invest in a company more than 12 years old. Well, I spoke to a few managers yesterday and they said to me, we rarely look at companies over 12 years old, so it's not really an issue. The other thing that's been changed, there's going to be a cap on total investment received from the EIS and VCTs of 15 million. Again, managers said, well, we don't particularly put more than 15 million into a company, so not a big issue. But there has been one positive change. They're going to increase the employee limit for what they call knowledge-intensive companies to 499 employees from the current 249. Now, we don't know what knowledge-intensive companies are by definition, but that's likely to be set out in the next week or two in draft legislation. Another positive move here, we're going to introduce a new type of VCT, social VCT. Again, details thin on the ground, but we do now know, as of the budget, they'll have similar tax relief to existing VCTs, namely 30% income tax relief, no tax on the dividends, and no capital gains tax on share disposals. When this comes in is uncertain. It just said the government will legislate for social VCTs in a future finance bill.
Okay, and all of these schemes are probably going to become a lot more appealing to people who think they might be nearing the lifetime limit on pensions, which was also cut in the budget.
To 1 million. Yeah.
So anyone who's a wealthy investor who's been building up funds might start to look at these tax advantage schemes, namely enterprise investment schemes and venture capital trusts in all their different forms.
Yes, if they're high risk. I mean, I think what has to be remembered about all these things, they are very high risk. They're not a substitute for a pension, so they will only suit a small minority of wealthy investors with a high-risk appetite.
Yes, and it will be a small part of your portfolio as well.
Yes, it shouldn't be. Advisors say it should be, you know, absolute maximum limit, 10% of your portfolio, and probably a lot less.
Okay. Now, Leonora, your big theme article in this week's magazine looks at how to choose an enterprise investment scheme. What do investors need to consider?
Right, when choosing an EIS, I think you have to remember there's a lot of different ones. It's not just a generic EIS. There's a lot of considerations, and picking the right one's going to be important for your particular tax planning need, your risk appetite, you know, what you want to do, how long you want to hold. And then it's important to choose one run by somebody with a good track record, because there's all sorts of people out there, and you don't want to go.
What do they typically invest in? What kinds of investments have you seen?
VCTs, EIS. Well, there's all sorts of early stage companies. Now, they fall into different categories. You get ones that invest in a single company, and this is really high risk because, you know, all your eggs in one basket. All the advisors I talk to say that most investors would be better at looking at an EIS that takes a portfolio approach. So it'll have a few companies. Now, it's still quite concentrated. When we say a few companies, that's maybe like four companies, eight companies, a lot less than your average unit trust, investment trust. But still, you know, four companies dilutes the risk over four. It's better than one. I mean, single company EIS invests in some really strange things, you know, like racehorses or vineyard or whatever. But portfolio ones, you'll find that they may be looking at early stage tech or biotech companies, you know, companies that could really grow something new. So I'd say this may be, you know, it's maybe more mainstream.
Yes. There are even some specialist pub investments,
yes,
aren't there as well?
Right. Yes, there are. You can find ones that take a portfolio approach to that, so you're not putting all your money into one pub. Most EIS fall into three broad categories. And if you know, depending on your risk appetite and tax planning, you're going to look at one of these. You get capital preservation. This is like lower risk companies, usually backed with strong revenues, with a focus on preserving the real value of capital, and achieving a 30% income tax relief and saving 40% inheritance tax. Then you get one's exit focus, investment of focus on a predictable exit as soon as possible after a 3-year minimum holding period. And then you get high growth ones, investment in order to build rapid organic growth, perhaps to establish a competitive advantage or support a management buyout. I mean, this is the riskiest form, but it is also the most common form of EIS investing.
So it will depend on your own tax needs and your appetite for risk as to which of these you go for.
Yes.
And for more ideas on what we think are good options.
Yeah, we've got a full article in the Investors Chronicle, which also has some advisor recommendations. recommendations of specific funds. So if you are interested in EIS, it'd be a good idea to look at the article before you do anything else. And if necessary, get professional advice, because this is a really high-risk area. So even if you can do everything yourself, tax planning, it's not something you mess about with, you know, get advice.
Great stuff. Thanks, Leonora. Also in this week's magazine, personal finance writer Kate Bearley has been looking at investing in Europe using exchange-traded funds and passive investments. Passive investments aim to reproduce the performance of a particular stock market index. But when you look at Europe, there are lots of different indices to choose from and different products that track them. So Kate, why do you think it's so important to get the right index? What have you found there?
Well, I think, as you say, there are so many products and so many indices in Europe. And ultimately, everything to do with the performance of your ETF is about the performance of that underlying index. Even if you have an ETF that tracks perfectly, if the index has lost 30%, then, you know, you've potentially lost a lot of money. And different indices give very different kind of access points to the European market. So if you're interested in just targeting value stocks, you would need a very different index to if you're just focused on having the most diverse range of stocks. So you really need to think about what your options are and what kind of index to go for.
Okay, so can you tell me a bit about the best options among the indices that you found?
Well, I think the way to look at it is to split it into the core indices and then some of the more what they call smart beta approaches or alternative beta approaches. So some of the kind of core ones that people would be most familiar with, I think, are the MSCI Europe, Euro Stoxx 50, Euro Stoxx 600, and FTSE Developed Europe. And again, there are more than that, but those are some of the key core ones.
So these are straightforward indices that are simply tracking big companies across Europe, really.
Yeah.
And they're not trying to do anything clever. They're just tracking the performance of the companies.
But even there, there's quite a high divergence between them. So, for example, the MSCI Europe has 439 constituents. Its biggest single exposure is to Nestlé. And it does have 31% exposure to the UK. So even though this is diverse, you know, if you hold a FTSE 100 or a lot of UK indices, you could be kind of doubling up there. I mean, it compares to something like the Euro Stoxx 50, which is 50 stocks and much more concentrated in that sense, but also more liquid, so easier to buy and sell potentially.
And some of these indices have exposure to the UK and some don't, am I right?
Yeah, that is right. And some are kind of more focused on different sectors than others. For example, the Stoxx Europe 600 is only focused on super sectors. So again, you need to think about what country particularly want exposure to and what sectors. But those are only the core ones. Then you've got these smart beta indices.
And smart beta is like a sort of technical overlay to get a different result. Yes.
The idea is they use a rule-based approach to isolate certain elements of the parent index. So they'll just try and take either, for example, the lowest volatility stocks or the highest value stocks. It's almost a kind of halfway house between passive and active.
Mm-hmm.
And this is good. For example, if you're worried about being exposed to volatile stocks in Europe, you could go for something like the MSCI Europe Minimum Volatility Index, which takes the lowest risk stocks from the MSCI Europe. Or you could go for something like the Euro Stoxx Low Risk Weighted 50, which takes the stocks from its parent index and gives the biggest weighting to the lowest volatile. Or alternatively, there are things like the Societe Generale European Quality Income Index, which just takes these stocks with the best yield. So, and I mean, again, it's an enormous and expanding area. But if you think, you know, you're particularly worried about value, volatility, things like that, it might be worth looking into one of those.
Okay, great. So choose your index, then find the product that tracks that index. And for more information about it, read this week's magazine. Kate, you've also written this week our fund tip. Can you tell us what you've chosen and a bit about it?
Yeah, this week I chose Target Healthcare Real Estate Investment Trust. It's a REIT which owns care home assets around the UK. And I've chosen it because it's an interesting kind of alternative source of income. So it's not a UK equity fund or a bond fund. And it has quite a high yield without being extremely high risk. The idea behind it is that the UK has an ageing population, so demand for care homes is on the increase. According to Age UK, the number of over 85s, who are the prime users of care homes, will double in the next 20 years. So there's quite a solid argument there for the underlying asset. And as I said, an alternative income source, so it's less correlated to potentially the other assets within your portfolio. And it also has quite a high yield. Based on the prospective dividend payout of 6.12 pence, its yield is just under 6%. So that's pretty high in the current environment. And it also has quite a reliable income stream in terms of rent from these care homes. The leases tend to be very long term, so about 30 years. And that income is inflation linked and tends to increase year on year. So that's all quite appealing in terms of income sustainability. The cost is 1.82% when performance fees are taken into account.
That sounds quite high, but it's a specialist vehicle though, isn't it? So
yeah,
you can't expect them to be incurring extra
costs. And I mean, when you're looking at kind of areas of alternative income, some do tend to be quite expensive and the premiums tend to be very high. If you're looking at infrastructure funds, for example, which would be a kind of another alternative to this, the premiums can be in the kind of double digits. The premium here is reasonably high. It's 9%, but that's nowhere near the kind of double digit territory of some other funds.
OK, so it's one to take a look at and maybe buy or put on your watch list.
Yeah.
Great stuff. So you can read more about the budget and enterprise investment schemes in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.